And welcome to Doc Talk. This is season 3, episode 2 of Doc Talk. And joining me today is my good friend, Captain Jeff Monroe with the International Association of Maritime and Port Executives. Jeff, hey, good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Always a pleasure. And I hope the weather has not been as chilly where you are as it has been here in South Carolina.
We are in the deep thaw and I like it. I just want to welcome all of our listeners from the United States, inland and coastal, and all of our listeners around the world. My heart goes out to all of the families that are currently, you know, experiencing that devastating loss that we've seen with the air crash in Washington, D.C. lately, just a month ago or so. My hearts go out to them. My heart breaks for you. And I know, Captain, yours does as well.
Well, it does. Yeah, certainly we've kept them in our prayers. And I think one of the things that was so impressive was the amount of response from our people who are in emergency response. You know, within 10 minutes, there were people on site. Within 45 minutes, they had, you know, over 300 people stepping up to the plate from every aspect. And it really emphasizes the need for people to work together. You know, oftentimes in our industry, we become too fixated on our silos, on what our jobs are, not recognizing that we do all of this together. And that was a very impressive to see how fast people responded. And it's just so unfortunate that, you know, no lives were saved.
So I felt this one a little bit personally, just because, number one, it's transportation. Well, number one, because it's human lives. Number two, because it's transportation. And then number three, because that wreckage ended up in the river, the Potomac River. And we know firsthand that any type of emergency response related to the river is going to be difficult. It automatically has certain challenges. So I, too, like you, was very impressed with the emergency response when it came to, you know, a river related type of disaster response and cleanup as well.
I think it's a great message to everybody. You know, when the Baltimore Bridge came down, everybody pulled together to try to get that cleaned up as quickly as possible, get the channel open and everything. We certainly saw that with this. And I think in the long run, recognizing that even though we represent many different agencies and many different groups and everything, like that, cooperation and communication between us is such an important thing. And whether you're a small port or big port really doesn't make any difference. The fact of the matter is that we need to get to know our partners. We need to trust our partners. We need to figure out how to work together, because it's not a question of if it happens. It's always a question of when it happens. And we never know what's gonna go on. Somebody asked me one time what was my biggest nightmare, and the flight path coming into the Portland Jet Port went right over the oil tanks in South Portland. And I said my biggest nightmare was that an aircraft would come in, lose power, hit one of the oil tanks, which were all located in very very highly populated areas, you know, and then would, you know, careen over to the airport and stuff like that. So, you know, you kind of think to yourself, how do these things happen? But then the question is, how do you work together when it does?
And it takes good leaders for us to work together, right? And so we saw a little bit of that with the new Secretary of the Department of Transportation and Sean Duffy at some of the press conferences. And I was pretty pleased with him so far. But you said something that strikes me there that takes us right into our first kind of topic of discussion today. Cooperation and communication is extremely important and crucial for times of disaster and emergency response, as is practice, right? We can communicate and we can cooperate, but we also have to practice those emergency drills so that, you know, muscle memory, when we get into that disaster or that time of need, it's a muscle memory that just starts reacting from what we've been practicing, right? And so there's a lot going on right now in terms of preparation and practice when it comes to river transportation. More specifically, and what we wanted to talk about a little bit today is the cybersecurity and the new U.S. Coast Guard regulations. So what are you hearing kind of high level as far as what those new regs might look like?
Well, I was very impressed to see that Jones Walker, who is one of our education partners and also one of your esteemed members, has a maritime practice group. And they put out a great summary, several weeks ago, which wound up in the press, which was very good to see. And it covered all of the aspects of what came about as a result of the initial regulation that got put in place in January. And I think the key factor here is that the regulations, which were triggered by the executive officer, executive order by President Biden, now puts it in place that, yeah, you've got to be in full compliance by July of this year. And then you've got an additional year beyond that to make sure you have a plan in place, that you have training in place. And I think the most interesting thing about it is that there's going to have to be a cybersecurity person who, in essence, is
Officer,
going
if
to be
you will.
coordinating all of this, and that that's going to take a while to figure out. The biggest issue is half the time we can't figure out exactly what cybersecurity is.
And once you do, that goalpost keeps moving, right? But I do think there's a lot of questions, at least inland, as far as who is subject to these new regulations? Is it everybody? Does every port or terminal or facility on the river need this new designated officer of cybersecurity within their facility?
Well, one of the things that I've always been an advocate for is that while coastal ports are required because of international trade to have these things in place under 33 CFR 105 as a result of the MTSA in 2002, they only apply to international operations. And we have encouraged the inland ports to take on some of the characteristics and some of the protections that have been necessary in the international trade to take it on themselves. For example, doing tariffs, which we thought, even though it's designed for international trade ports, that these are good things for terminals to have in place because they're protective documents. So under 33 CFR, if your facility is subject to those security regulations under the MTSA, then you have to comply with this. But if you're domestic and that's all you handle is domestic operations, then you don't need to comply with it. However, that being said, we need to find ourselves in a position where these things are very good guidelines. These things are excellent in regards to protecting ourselves. And even though we deal in domestic trade on the inland rivers, the fact of the matter is that it's just as easy to hack a system like that as it is to hack a system on the international side.
Now, I'm confused because I understood the new regulation to mean if you are regulated as an MTSA facility, you must have this new cyber policy in place. There are facilities inland that do not handle international cargo that are regulated by MTSA, perhaps because of the kinds of commodities that they handle. Maybe it's a hazardous type of material, et cetera, combustible material. Whatever, but I believe that it's if you are MTSA regulated, you also now have to comply with this new cyber
That's
regulation.
exactly true. So it's kind of like this, all right? How many inland ports I've been to where I can drive right in, there's really no security, there's no gates, there's no check-in or anything like that. You get your free rein of the facility and stuff like that. I think ultimately what people come to recognize is that we deal with theft issues in facilities that don't have even a remedial security in place. We deal with a lot of other issues with those ports. So what I'm saying is that if you're a domestic port and you're not subject to these regulations, all right, then that's fine. But what great guidelines there are. Every person that's in business, every terminal operation and everything like that should be looking at these things and saying to themselves, you know what, is this makes sense? Because this is really one of the first time, even though we've seen it come out of like Det Norsk Veritas and ABS and a whole pile of other people in regards to security, BIMCO has put it out. This is now concisely pulled together and said, this is the standard that the federal government is going to run by in regards to marine transportation protection. And it also applies to vessels as well, to international vessels. But if I'm headed down a river, right, and I'm moving a lot of cargo, And I may not be subject to part 104, right, as opposed to part 105, right? But somebody hacks into my vessel control system, that's a big issue. So it is important, I think, that even though it might not be required, right, that our facilities should look at these guidelines, see what's applicable, and institute them, right, for their own self-protection.
I think there's still, I'm still confused. There are facilities, and I want to give some specific examples here because there are facilities that, maybe back in the day when they first started that particular dock or facility, maybe they did not carry a hazardous material. So at that point, they were not considered regulated but under MTSA, right? Since then, in business development and new shippers and new markets have opened up, now they handle a certain commodity, but they don't know that by handling that commodity, they are now regulated. So they now don't know, not only are you regulated by MTSA, but now you have to have that cyber component. Maybe they didn't know to tell the Coast Guard, oh, hey, I got a new business over here. I'm now handling something else as well. If youngins come into the industry and we start taking over operations from the old crusties that just have been doing business the way they've been
The
doing
old
business.
crusties like me.
Yes, I'm just saying, but like what if we weren't trained or taught that, hey, if you do this 20 years from now, you're gonna have to tell the Coast Guard and you're gonna have to do X, Y, and Z. Like if you don't know, I mean, ignorance is not an excuse to non-compliance. However, I think this is an excellent opportunity to be telling the industry, hey, if you're doing this, you may need to consider that now you may be MTSA regulated and must comply with these new regs.
I think in the long run, nobody likes to be told what to do. And we've been an industry that has argued against this for years. But here's the bottom line here. It takes a phone call to the Coast Guard to pick up the phone and just say, basically, hey, look, here's who we are, here's what we do. Come on down and do an assessment. They'll be happy to do an assessment and come down. It doesn't cost you anything. And they'll take a look around and look at all of your operations and everything and say, yeah, you know what? You're fine. Or maybe you should be thinking about a higher level of security, or basically you must comply with the regulations. And I'll give you a good example of that. Potassium nitrate, right? Which of course is a fertilizer, but it's also used as a dangerous explosive, and has been used by terrorists and everything. When Beirut blew up, right, they had all this potassium nitrate in storage and everything, took out the port and a good part of the community. In the United States, we have a whole series of regulations, right, that are similar to, and fall under the 33 CFR that deal with these type of hazardous materials and stuff. So those terminals know they're subject to that. All right. The terminals that may often may not know about that are those that handle random cargoes or something like that that are on international bills of lading. So it doesn't take much time to pick up the phone and just call and just say, hey, Coast Guard, what do you think?
It's an
Because I'd
excellent.
rather do that proactively than all of a sudden find out if I have an accident that, hey, didn't you guys know that you were subject to certain regulations that you didn't comply with? Now you're not only dealing with the issues with insurance and everything else, but you're also dealing with regulatory issues.
It's an excellent example because actually some terminals, after the Oklahoma City bombing occurred with the potassium nitrate, some terminals stopped handling it for that specific reason. So again, going back to my scenario of maybe the younger generation coming in trying to learn from, the older generation and not being told if you change things up, you may need to reconsider. But in some cases, now we're not handling the same type of cargoes that we were handling. We were MTSA regulated. Now maybe we're not, we shouldn't be regulated because we're no longer handling those kinds of materials. It's a back and forth, right?
It is. And cost is always a factor. And I recognize that, particularly with small businesses, people say, well, if I do this now, I'm going to have to spend more money. But the thing is, just think about the amount of money you're going to spend if something happens.
So I've got some really good news for you. So a few years ago, and we've been talking about it for at least 5 years now, in your persistence in our United States of America needing a nationwide freight plan, some nationwide approach to healthy growth for freight investments, et cetera. So do I have news for you? Yeah. I think you've pushed the needle a little bit. You've encouraged the right person because
Thrown my weight behind it, so to speak.
You've thrown your weight behind it. Yes. You've pushed your weight around. The Department of Transportation has come out with a national multimodal freight network map. It's a draft map. They've put it out for comment period through the Federal Register. Actually, they've put it out twice. The first time, back April of 24, they've said, hey, we're thinking about doing this draft map network. If we did this, how would you use it? And the industry responded with, well, we'd like to see you, use this draft map to prioritize discretionary funding. Other people have said, we'd like for you to use that map so that metropolitan planning organizations can consider the freight flows in, out, and through their communities. And so DOT listened, they built this map, and all of a sudden, there's 137 maritime ports that were put on this national freight network map. You know how many ports are in America? At least 335, but they've only put 137 on there.
Maybe they ran out of ink in their pencils.
No, what they've done is they've said, if you handle more than 1.5 million tons of cargo, then we'll put you on this map. But think about it this way. Say there's a port that handles 1.4 million tons of cargo. I don't do math in public, but 1.4 million tons of cargo equals how many additional semi-trucks?
Well, if you think about 80,000 pounds per truck, and I don't have my calculator handy
No,
here,
right? I'll do it.
Let's put it this way. It's a shipload.
It's a ship ton.
You know,
So that port, that 1.4 million in the eyes of DOT didn't warrant freight consideration or discretionary funding prioritization. However, 1.4 million tons could drastically impact negatively a community if that freight is not considered how it's being moved to and from the port, right?
Because it's freight in and empty truck out or the other way around. And this seems to be the problem oftentimes with the government. These are like little band-aids that somebody says, oh, let's do this, right? The thing is that this needs really a top-down operation, a top-down approach where somebody says, I understand the full scope of the logistics chain, and these are the questions we have to answer. These are the things we have to address. And no slight to the military. Military does a good job moving their own cargo and stuff like that. But we're talking about commercial activities here. And when they formed the task force after, COVID, or, during COVID to try to address a lot of these issues, what they didn't do was really focus on so many of the little paramount pieces that were in there that needed to be linked together. So I'm hoping that the new administration will focus on this. I'm hoping that the new Department of Transportation secretary will come to recognize that it's not about wings and tires, and rail. It's also about the maritime. You cannot have a comprehensive transportation policy in the United States without including all modes of transportation.
So let's dive a little bit deeper into that, because 137 marine publicly governed ports is pales in comparison to the thousands of marine terminals that are actually moving the freight. So again, not only are we saying we're not going to count all of the marine ports in the US, but now we're not even going to consider the millions and millions of tons of freight being moved by private terminals. And some private terminals might say, hey, we don't want them to know that we're here. And I get that, right? But on this freight map, they have short line railroads. If you care enough about the freight moving by a private corporation on rail, you should be caring about the freight that's moving by private terminal by water.
I'm right now in the middle of a project dealing with one of the states down south where they're now in the second phase of this project where they're looking at every terminal, they're looking at the waterway system, they're looking at rail and road and all the component pieces on how they all fit together and how, in essence, to coordinate it. And one of the things that I've seen is that other states down south have looked at it and say, well, that seems like a good idea. We should be doing that as well. But, that's great until you get to the borders of the state. I'm very happy that the states are looking into this, and I'm very happy that the states are focused on this. But somewhere along the line, all of that good data, which is being gathered now by various states, particularly in the Inland Riverside, all of that data needs to be collected and put together as part of that comprehensive plan. You know, we always focus on international cargo, which represents only 10% of all of the moves in the United States, right? And 90% of it is domestic, and it's moving by water and by rail and by truck. And the bottom line is nobody's taken a bird's eye view of this, and they haven't since Harry Truman was president.
So I've heard. So if you're a private terminal and you're moving 7 million tons of crude oil on the river, right? We got to get the crude to the river. Maybe, you've got some local distribution there as well. And you're not considering how 8 million tons of petroleum are moving through the city to get to the terminal to then put on the river. Think about the impact that that's going to make on your community. It's like a
Well, we're honestly hoping that the new DOT secretary will focus on this. But the only reason that they focus on this is that they hear from the constituencies, which means that every one of your members, every one of my members, should be writing letters to the DOT secretary. Granted, he's only been there for a short period of time, but at least if he hears from the maritime constituency. But more so to say, not only should you include maritime, right, but you should also include all of the aspects of total transportation. You cannot look at this in modes. You have to look at it systematically. I wrote a letter to Lindsey Graham and to Senator Collins and said, hey, look, pay attention. You know, and I know Senator Collins knows it very well because I worked with her very closely up in Maine. But I think in the long run here, they have to pay attention to it, right? And
absolutely.
get off of some of these other things and get focused on what's important right now.
I commit to writing a letter. I hope all of our members write a letter. I know that you're going to write a letter. You have communicated, but I'm going to Washington. I want them to know, we're here. We matter. Our members matter. I hope you come to Washington with me. I hope I see a lot of our members up there. But I'm excited to go. I'm going next month, March 10, 11, and 12. So I hope to see everyone there.
Yeah, I got it on my calendar. I'll see if I can pry myself loose.
Nice.
So, but in the course of time here, you know, we're seeing a lot of other issues. I know we're hoping for the continuation of the grant funding for the ports, which I think is an important thing. We got a lot of work done, you know, in the last couple of years, and there's still money allocated and set aside for projects if none of it gets held up and everything like that. I just think it's important that somewhere along the line, all of our key elected officials, new administration, new opportunities, right? Get out there and take a look at what's going on. And the only way to do that is to get onto the ground and get to the ports, not only just the big guys. All right. I remember when Gina Marconi was the port director up in Portsmouth, Senator, I mean, President Biden went to visit him. You know, it was a great photo op, but you know, Biden said to him, he says, what's the problems that you're facing? And he laid it out for him, you know. So the bottom line here is that, you know, our small ports are just as important as our big ports because collectively, as you know, more tonnage is moved down the Western rivers of the United States than any other waterway in the world, right? And
Right.
they have to pay attention to it, right?
That's right.
And you know, they just keep deferring and deferring because there's more important things to worry about.
There's always
Yeah.
going to be something more important, right? Some shiny object to look at.
And
But
cargo doesn't vote.
we have to be the squeaky wheel, right? Because if not us, then who, right?
Exactly.
So, but I do want to mention because, there's a lot of talk in the news lately about the freeze on federal spending in terms of grants and loans. I am pretty confident that that's going to free up, that we're going to get back to investing into our port infrastructure through PIDP and hopefully through the U.S. Marine Highways Program and more. I think that was just kind of their way of, just kind of really putting, hey, let's take just a step back, see what we're working with, see what makes sense. But I'm fully confident that we're gonna, continue this growth and investment that we've seen over the last few years.
Yes, and you got a couple facilities coming on board around the country, some new facilities. You have in Charleston, there's a new facility there. St. Bernard Parish in New Orleans is moving forward and stuff like that. I think one of the things that scared the behoots out of everybody was the tariffs on Chinese cranes. And I think in the long run, they put an exception in, as long as everybody has their cranes delivered, ordered after a certain date or between a certain date and delivered with a certain date. And I think that will work it. But I just find it interesting with all the ports of the United States that our crane manufacturers haven't gotten to the point where we're building cranes in the United States.
I
We are
know.
constantly renewing this stuff.
Yeah.
All right. We're constantly needing new equipment. Right. It's not like we don't have the technology to do this, but I think in the long run, the big companies that develop these STS cranes, and as also the smaller cranes, for us on the Western rivers, need to come to understand that, when we get federal funding, we have to buy US, right? And if your cranes are made in China, or your cranes are made in Ireland or something like that, that's going to create a big problem. The federal government will pay for a bunch of parts of it, but it really we have to be very innovative about how we invest that money. So I think in the long run, it's time for them to recognize that. And you're saying, what your number are. We know there's 361 commercial ports just on the coast, right? Plus, over 10,000 terminals world, all over North America and particularly in the United States. And many of them are up in the river system and stuff like that. And nobody's accounting for them because they're not part of public port infrastructure. And
Right,
that's
exactly.
Yeah, and that's a problem because how can you look at the total system and say, well, they're not big enough or we have to ignore them? And that's, I think sometimes if you get these really 40,000 foot views, people thinking, well, I'm doing something. No, they're not.
Right. Well, I want to invite all of our listeners to come see us in person pretty soon. I know, like I said, I'm going to be in Washington, March 10, 11, 12. Come see us there. You can also come and see us. We're going to be in person in St. Louis, March 25th. We'll be in Memphis, March 26th. We've got events all over the country in the next couple of months. So I hope that our listeners will come and join us and meet us in person, hear about all the great work that we're doing, but more importantly, get to know our members who are moving this freight, who are passionate about the river industry. So, what do you have coming up?
Well, we've just finished a course in Tampa, Florida, and we've booked a course at more terminals in New Jersey. We've also booked a course in Baltimore, Maryland, and also in Norfolk, Virginia, and working on several other ports as well. The thing that's got me most excited is that we had a very successful Spanish language program in Puerto Rico, right? And I just want to point out none of my faculty brought me back a bottle of rum, which I will hold them accountable for. But we've had very good meetings with Australia, and of course, there's a lot of great ports down there as well. And they're one of our academic partners, the University of the Maritime College of Australia, which is in Tasmania. So we're looking forward to putting those pieces together. So we're getting more and more worldwide, which is wonderful. And as I've often mentioned, we're the only ones that provide this professional certification. So many of your members, have gone through our programs, and have received these certifications. We have another one planned with the ports of Indiana this year, which I think will be good as well. So, for the most part, it's been exciting. And I've got a wider range of faculty now. It's not just me doing the programs, but other faculty and stuff who've stepped up to the plate, very highly qualified because they have to go through a qualification process. We're looking forward to working them hard. And, they've been already taking on different courses and stuff like that. So that has worked out very well. So hopefully we'll see some of the folks in our courses. The one thing I noticed, Amy, is our industry is getting younger. Where I used to say we'd see these old duffers like me would come in just for the certification. Now we're seeing, low-level managers, mid-level managers, and of course, senior managers still taking the programs. But it has worked out very nicely because what it does for us is that it gets the boards and the commissions to look at their people and say, yeah, we're going to hire this person because they have excellent qualifications, and we're going to bring them on board. And as I have mentioned to you many times, you know, a third of the people who take our programs are women, which is great to see. I think we're an industry that has been very sensitive to minorities. We've been very sensitive to being women in the industry. You know, my daughter's a great example of that, making it all the way to captain, you know, so and sailing as master. So I think in the long run, you know, before there was all this talk about,
DEI.
you know, all this other stuff, that we were already out in front of it.
We made DEI look cool before DEI was cool.
I could hardly spell DEI. So I
Captain, like always, you make me laugh. It's such a great opportunity just to get together with you and talk about some of these topics. I really enjoy your perspective on all things maritime. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Always a pleasure, Amy. I always enjoy these conversations. You always make me think, which is good. And
Oh, I hope that's a good thing.
it is. And you know, before I got involved with IRPT and everything like that, my perspective on the Western Rivers ended at Baton Rouge, right? So
For
now I have a
shame.
much wider perspective on the industry,
And
which is great.
shame.
So always a
Thank
pleasure.
you. Thank you. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us today. And we look forward to hearing any feedback that you'd like to offer us. You're always welcome to email our producer or Jeff and I personally. So thank you again. And until next time.
Take care, everybody. Keep it between the anchors.
Thank you.